Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we'll hear a special report by the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting about a controversial pastor and state lawmaker in Kentucky, Danny Ray Johnson.
We have worshipped other gods and called it multiculturalism. We have rewarded laziness and we've called it welfare.
But as we'll hear, this report revealed some unsettling facts about Johnson's personal life. In the middle of the publication of this investigative report, Johnson's life took a tragic and shocking turn.
You know, you always say like, oh, that's the last thing I expected to happen. Well, it wasn't even the last thing. Like, it wasn't even on our radar. Like, we never even thought that would be the case about how it would end. So yeah, I mean, we were just all shocked.
A story about politics, religion, deception, media, and death this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Our show for you today is a little different. We'll feature a story from our friends at the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting in Louisville, Kentucky. They looked into a Kentucky State House politician who's not from Appalachia, but someone whose character might sound familiar. They dug deep and found, well, let's just listen to a segment from the first of a five-part series.
Everybody's talking about the seventh son in the whole wide world. There is only one. I'm the one. I'm the one. I'm the one. I'm the one. The one they call seventh son.
I'm Jake Ryan, and in this story, you'll hear from me and my colleague, R.G. Dunlop. We're going to take you from Bullitt County, Kentucky, to Bastrop, Louisiana, and back, unraveling the strange and remarkable story of Danny Ray Johnson. Let's start with the 2016 election.
The man who posted images of President Barack Obama with ape-like features pulled out a narrow victory.
The night was full of big surprises, from the White House all the way to the State House. In Kentucky, Republicans seized control of the state legislature for the first time in nearly a century. The trouncing of Democrats extended to House District 49 in Bullitt County, just south of Louisville. Donald Trump crushed Hillary Clinton in Bullitt, winning nearly three-quarters of the vote. And in the 49th district race, political unknown and preacher Danny Ray Johnson beat the popular Democratic incumbent Linda Lou Belcher by just 156 votes. Johnson's campaign was strange from the start. He wasn't the original GOP nominee. He barely campaigned in person. He was criticized, even by his own party, for racist rants on social media. And he made personal attacks against Belcher, a 69-year-old former public school official. Here's R.G. Dunlop.
Johnson's political campaign looked and sounded a lot like that of another political newcomer.
November the 8th, guess what? This is a Donald Trump and Dan Johnson against the likes of criminal Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and lying Linda Lou.
Facebook videos like this one were the fuel for his successful run for office.
Let's defeat them. Let's show them that the good old boys matter.
The videos flooded Johnson's Facebook page leading up to Election Day. He rambles, talks about his life's accomplishments, and aligns himself with Trump. He says the media went out of their way to attack Trump.
The same thing's happened with me. I've had this onslaught of negative media.
In reality, Johnson's campaign got virtually no media coverage, except for stories about his racist Facebook posts.
You're elite people that think that we are nothing. You don't count.
He insults President Barack Obama and Islam. Johnson also batters his opponent, Belcher, with attack after attack.
She has killed over 80,000 babies in the last 20 years. She's been in office 12. She's lobbied for killing babies for 20 years.
No, that is just a fabrication to try and make me look bad.
Belcher is a lifelong Bullitt County resident.
I was a principal and a teacher for 32 years. I've worked very hard to establish a good reputation in this county.
Her husband Larry held the 49th district seat for 6 years before he died in a car accident in 2008. Belcher then served three terms. She's a Democrat in a county that's becoming more and more Republican.
Oh, I think people get disenchanted with what's going on in Frankfort and Washington, and we have young people who have different views about what they want, and there doesn't seem to be the party loyalty that there was at one time.
That's where Danny Ray Johnson comes in. He's 57 years old. He calls himself the Pope.
America is great, and it needs to be restored to its greatness. Amen.
Jonathan was using Donald Trump's tagline long before Trump himself. Several years before running for office, Johnson had made a name for himself in right-wing and libertarian circles.
We're in a country right now that's not loved by a whole world. We're in a country today that's hated by a lot of nations. But I will tell you what I do know and what you know and what all those countries know, that when there's ever been a need, our country has been there because we do believe in God.
This is Johnson in 2013, before giving the invocation at a Reclaim America Now rally outside the White House. He's wearing a clergy collar and a black suit with a cross around his neck. He's a big guy, about 6'2" and 200 pounds. He's got thinning blonde hair and sideburns.
I've got a lot of friends here today. I've got Americans here today.
At the rally, Johnson introduces himself as Bishop.
I am Bishop Dan Johnson, pastor, founder of Heart of Fire Church, Heart of Fire Ministries.
He talks about his supposedly heroic actions after 9/11. Then he offers a prayer.
Heavenly Father, we come before you. We ask forgiveness. We have worshiped other gods and called it multiculturalism. We have endorsed perversion and called it an alternative lifestyle. We have exploited the poor and called it the lottery. We have rewarded laziness and we've called it welfare. We have killed our unborn, and we've called it choice.
A year later, Johnson was back in Washington. This time, it was for a rally called 2 Million Bikers. The crowd was actually less than 100,000. The bikers had come to D.C. to protest a Muslim event.
I am an infidel because I believe in Jesus Christ. I am an infidel because I still love this country. And by the way, I believe the Constitution needs to stay intact.
Yeah. In another video from 2014 on guns.com, Johnson holds an assault rifle and rails against the government, which he'd be part of barely 2 years later. Here he answers questions from Ben Phillippe.
Why do you feel it's so important as a Christian to be armed?
I believe, you know, Jesus taught us to be armed, It is important.
And you got an AK-47 there, I believe.
Yes, it's like one of my favorite home defense, and it's also one of my favorite anti-mean government guns.
It's a gun that works.
It works.
Very dependable.
It's dependable. The real reason for our Second Amendment rights is that we have a gun to keep a mean-spirited government off of us that if they go crazy, you know, we got to have something to be crazier with. So that's what it's like.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. And that was a segment from the first part of a series called The Pope's Long Con from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. I want to introduce the reporters behind this investigation into Danny Ray Johnson.
I'm R.G. Dunlop. My role in this report was to be one of the two reporters and report, write, help edit, and whatever else was needed.
I'm Jacob Ryan. My role in this story was also to help report, write, edit, and produce this story, The Pope's Long Con.
We're both reporters with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting.
When did y'all decide to produce any kind of story about Danny Johnson? Like, how did this come to your attention to even look into profiling this individual?
Well, the story began with a tip. The tipster said, I hate hypocrites in politics. What do you know about Dan Johnson? And I didn't really know anything much about him, so that's why we had a subsequent conversation. And what he told me pertained to a car fire back in the 1980s. And in hindsight, if we got a tip about a car fire in the 1980s, we might think, well, we're not going to spend any time on that. But I did do a little bit of research and got some documents and then learned some other things about other issues pertaining to Mr. Johnson. Literally, one thing just led to another, and we'd hear more and check more and kind of be jaw-dropping about, wow, did you hear the latest? And the sum total of them seemed to us to be worthy of continuing our pursuit.
So when did you all realize that it deserved an entire series?
A few months after we had uncovered, I guess, a string of interesting threads about Danny Johnson, we kind of got together and thought, what is this? You know, what are we going to do with all of this stuff? So we got together, Ralph, myself, and our former editor Brendan McCarthy got together in a room and just kind of took stock of everything that we had. Then we kind of just settled on a serialized podcast. There's an appetite for them right now, and we decided to just do that.
What they had was evidence that many of Mr. Johnson's claims were fabricated. The work was even recognized with the National Award for Investigative Journalism and also won a Peabody Award. In a minute, we'll learn what dramatic event occurred just after this story aired, and we'll hear more from this series, The Pope's Long Con. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Today on Inside Appalachia, we're listening to a series from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting called The Pope's Long Con, about Danny Ray Johnson, a non-denominational pastor and a Kentucky politician. It would be great if we could play all of it, but we're limited on time, so let's hear a bit of the next chapter of this investigation.
We are living in one of the poorest areas of the United States.
This is where Danny Ray Johnson grew up. Remember, he bills himself as a former White House chaplain, 9/11 first responder, and as an ambassador with the UN. But when you ask the mayor of Bastrop about local celebrities, Johnson's name never comes up.
You know, you're talking about people like Willie Parker, played pro football, Calvin Natt, played with the Utah Jazz, Bob Love, played with Chicago.
But no Danny Ray Johnson. At Bastrop High School, the only trace of Johnson we found is his graduation picture in the 1979 yearbook. He has a blonde mullet. He's grinning. He was voted neatest in the class. The book says he was in the school's rock band, the history club, and the journalism club.
Okay.
We leave the school and head down State Highway 139 to Ouachita Parish and the Swartz First Assembly of God Church. Gerald Lewis has been the pastor here for 50 years. He's cutting the grass.
Pastor Lewis.
Hey, bro.
Y'all want to come in?
Well, we don't want to stand out here in the sun.
This was Danny Ray Johnson's church. Johnson says he started preaching as a teenager. We asked Lewis what he remembers.
I don't know if I ever heard him preach or not.
He didn't preach here?
I don't remember him ever preaching behind the pulpit. What he sang. He's a good singer.
On Sunday?
Uh-huh. Wednesday? I mean, we had Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. He was very involved in the church, and he did well. I mean, I have nothing against Danny. My memories of him at that time was he was a great young man, you know. I considered him like a son. In fact, he was in my son's marriage ceremony.
But one day, Johnson was gone. Lewis says he never came back to the church. He doesn't remember why.
Now he wouldn't have just left here and went to another church.
Lewis says he always thought Johnson wanted something bigger than Bastrop.
Danny always had these dreams of doing something big, you know. Here he goes again writing. Danny just didn't get in there and work like he ought to. He wanted to go out and mingle with the people like a celebrity.
With lots of unanswered questions, our next stop is to see Johnson's parents.
He grew up right here.
This house right here?
Right here.
Oh.
We're a couple of reporters from Kentucky who showed up unannounced asking lots of questions about their son. Jerry and Charlene Johnson are understandably guarded.
You know, I'm just looking you in the eye and telling you, I don't know what you want to hear.
Say what you want us to tell you.
You know, I don't know what y'all are trying to pick up on.
They say they're still close with Johnson.
Oh, we're close.
Telephone close.
We're very close, but but when you live that many miles away, you know what I'm saying. You just, it's not like one living right next door to you, you know. You miss out on a few things.
Right.
They tell us more about one of Johnson's most curious claims. It's in the very first line of his biography on the church's website. It says Johnson was healed of blindness at age 7.
He was just shooting a BB gun, and it, what did it do, glance off?
It ricocheted back and hit him in the eye.
Hit him in the eye.
It was bad. The white and pupil ran together.
It was red.
His mother carried him to the doctor and also carried him to the revival that was going on, and the prayers that went up, and he got healed of the blindness.
He sure did.
So you all think it was the Lord healed him of the blindness?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, it certainly was God.
It's not totally clear to us exactly what happened to Johnson's vision or how it healed. We do know Johnson went through some rocky times after high school. He was married, had a kid, got divorced 3 years later. He had some money problems and filed bankruptcy. He ended up in Kentucky in 1985. He started working at a church just south of downtown Louisville, and in 1987, he married his current wife, Rebecca Johnson. Most of what we know about Johnson's early life in Kentucky is from court documents, police records, and interviews with officials and people who knew him. And what we found tells a very different story than the one Johnson tells about himself.
Shortly after he got to Louisville, Johnson landed in jail on his birthday. Court records say he cooked up a plot to torch his own Cadillac for insurance money. Police found the car shortly after midnight on October 18, 1985, Johnson's 25th birthday. It was a brown 1982 Coupe de Ville, parked near the Ohio River. The tires and wheels were gone. The car had been doused with gasoline, inside and out. When officers happened to pass by, they saw two people trying to run away. Once in custody, they said Johnson had given them $200 to burn up the car. They said he told them they could keep the wheels and tires as a bonus. Johnson had left the Cadillac in the church parking lot and gave them an extra set of keys. Then he went out with other church staff to celebrate his birthday. Shortly after the party ended, early the next morning, Johnson was in a police cruiser heading downtown. At first, he said he hadn't given anyone permission to drive the car. It must have been stolen. He had no clue. He even filed a stolen vehicle report. But when police read him his rights and told him his co-conspirators had confessed, he came clean. He'd willingly handed over the keys. He'd paid to have the car destroyed. He was hoping to collect on the insurance because he was about to go broke. Johnson owed more than $10,000 on the car, which also needed repairs totaling thousands more. This wasn't the first time he'd had money trouble. Remember, he'd filed for bankruptcy in Louisiana several years earlier. Johnson was eventually indicted for complicity to commit arson and making a false police report. He went through a diversion program, and the criminal charges were dismissed. The woman Johnson paid to carry out the plot was a 31-year-old member of his church named Sharon Stubbins. She's now 63. She lives in a modest apartment in southern Indiana. We knocked on her door, hoping to find out what she remembered.
Hello.
Who are you?
Miss Stubbins.
Before he married Rebecca Johnson, the Pope was close to Stubbins. At least in one respect.
You remember going on dates? Where y'all went for dates or anything like that?
I'm not actually certain that we were, like you would say, dating as far as at a restaurant or anything. I don't think so.
Would y'all just like hang out, go for drinks or something like that?
Don't think we did that either.
It was more of a personal, like a sexual thing.
Just hook up.
Yep.
In the last chapter, we told you about Johnson's habit of putting racist posts on his Facebook page. Sharon Stubbins is black.
Was there any sign or indication from him then that about his beliefs about race?
It couldn't have been if he was screwing me.
What?
Stubbins didn't want to talk much about the incident that landed her and Johnson in trouble. But she looks back on it with regret. She hasn't talked to him since they got arrested more than 3 decades ago, but she's heard about his rise to political notoriety and his online racism.
He's just stuck on stupid.
Years later, in a lawsuit, he'd be asked about the car again, and again Johnson would lie. His story this time, when the Cadillac came up missing, he didn't know what had happened to it. He said it had been vandalized. This time he was under oath. He'd sworn to tell the truth, but he didn't.
If you believe his claims of greatness, Danny Ray Johnson pops up at major moments in history, like Forrest Gump. He's always there, right in the middle of things. Sometimes he says he served in positions that didn't even exist.
The jury in the Rodney King case has delivered its verdict, and not one of the four police officers seen on videotape beating Mr. King a year ago is guilty of using excessive force. They've all been found not guilty.
In 1992, Los Angeles was on fire. On his website, at rallies, and in campaign videos, Johnson said he was there in L.A., trying to defuse the violence and setting up so-called safe zones.
Setting those up the day before the Rodney King riots happened, that's something God did just by destiny.
The Reverend Dr. Cecil Murray really was there. At the time, Murray led the First African Methodist Episcopal Church of Los Angeles with a congregation of nearly 18,000. During the riots, he could see the fires from his church. Well, do you know, sir, whether there were safe zones in Compton? Was there any such thing, to your knowledge?
None.
He doesn't remember seeing a tall, blonde-haired white man from Kentucky setting up any safe zones. And he thinks he would have known.
It would be surprising if they existed, and I had no knowledge of it.
We couldn't find any mention of Johnson in the media coverage, and no references to safe zones. Continuing his pattern of alleged heroics, Johnson says he assumed one of the most powerful religious positions in the world, advising U.S. presidents over a period of 20 years.
I served as a chaplain to the White House under Presidents H.W. Bush, under William Jefferson Clinton, and also under George W. Bush, chaplain to the White House.
That would definitely be incorrect.
Gary Scott Smith is a retired college professor. He's written two books about religious faith and the presidency. He says there's no such thing as an office of White House chaplain. There's never been one.
If someone said I was a spiritual advisor to several presidents, a spiritual confidant, I had a close spiritual relationship with, that certainly could be true. But to say I was the chaplain to a president would be false.
The individual's name is Danny Ray Johnson.
I have never heard that name before. I think it's safe to say that for the presidents that I've studied, that he was not on the radar screen.
We asked the three presidential libraries. They also said they had no evidence linking Johnson to the White House. Johnson also says he served as an ambassador to the United Nations.
I served as an ambassador with the UN for several years, as the ambassador of peace.
We did some research. There's no such position as ambassador of peace. The UN does have messengers of peace, chosen by the Secretary General. People like cellist Yo-Yo Ma, Princess Haya of Jordan, actor George Clooney, opera singer Luciano Pavarotti, and Muhammad Ali. Johnson isn't one of them.
We've been listening to excerpts from the first two parts of an investigative series by R.G. Dunlop and Jacob Ryan, reporters with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting. This second chapter of the five-part series aired for the first time December 12, 2017. That day, Johnson held a press conference at his church where he denied the accusations. Then the next day, something totally unexpected happened.
You know, you always say, like, oh, that's the last thing I expected to happen. Well, it wasn't even the last thing. Like, it wasn't even on our radar. Like, we never even thought that would be the case about how it would end. So yeah, I mean, we were just all shocked.
Danny Ray Johnson killed himself. When did you all find out that he had committed suicide? How did you find out?
A few hours before he had committed suicide, he posted a note on his Facebook page. And during this time, we were actively rolling out the podcast on our radio station, like on the radio platform. We release the entire web story on Monday, but then each day at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, we would air each chapter as it came out. So we had just listened to that day's chapter, and we went back up to our desks, and we're just scrolling Facebook page because we were looking for some reaction too, because this was a day after Johnson had given a press conference when he was defiant and kind of brushed aside all of the allegations that we had found and raised and uncovered and reported in the story. And so we were just looking to see if he had done anything else or said anything else, and we saw the note. We thought it was a bit strange, kind of out of character maybe for him. So then it was shortly thereafter, I think we were all home for the day, and a local television station had reported that Johnson had killed himself. None of us foresaw that happening. You know, Danny Ray Johnson was a defiant figure in Kentucky politics, and we expected, if anything, he would brush this aside and never mention us again. You know, he would push us away at future press conferences. We figured he'd run for office again, and you know, we didn't think he would be fazed by this story.
How did you all cope with that? As in, professionally, personally, was it difficult?
Yeah, there was a lot of emotions in the newsroom from people that weren't directly involved. But this was the type of story where, you know, everyone in the newsroom kind of helped out. Rather, you know, it was picking up where something else was falling off because it was such a heavy haul. So I think everyone kind of like felt the impact of that. And then we had an all staff meeting and we kind of discussed it with all of our staff, you know, not just the newsroom, but also like our underwriting staff and hosts and our technical staff. Everyone kind of got together and like talked about their feelings and stuff.
Has this report changed either one of you in any significant ways as a professional in regards to methodology or even personally?
For me, no. And I think it hasn't changed anything for us in terms of methodology, because whatever else you can say about the outcome, our story was and is rock solid as far as we know. Nobody ever questioned substantively any aspect of it, major, minor. So the story stood. We did our job, and we think we did our job well, and we continue to do the same kind of work. We're doing it right now and using the same kind of protocols, and we have the same in-house discussions, and we do the same fact-checking and record-checking and getting out in the field. And so, in my opinion, it's kind of business as usual. Jake?
If it's changed anything, it's kind of made us, as an organization here, I think, open our eyes to the abilities that we have to kind of get great stories out. And, you know, if we do take some time, we can produce beautiful audio. And that's what we did. And I think that, you know, from an organizational standpoint, I think that if we are more accepting of taking the time to do this, doing more ambitious projects. Because this, I think, at the time this aired, it was our most ambitious project that we had done. And I think now people kind of see the value in that. Because, I mean, the feedback that we got was from across the country, of people that were very appreciative of this work. And I think that speaks volumes to the fact that there's an appetite for real kind of investigative journalism out there that truly does hold people accountable. And I hope that picks up here and at other local newsrooms, because local journalism is super important.
The team at Louisville Public Media publicly expressed condolences, and while the print version of all 5 chapters of this story were already available online, the team decided to release the rest of the audio series all at once, instead of rolling it out as scheduled day by day. Let's hear some of the next chapter that's titled An Empire Built on Blind Faith.
This is a video of the Heart of Fire Church Gun Choir. It's one of the church's more unconventional elements.
I once was lost, but now I'm found.
The video, featured on guns.com, shows Danny Ray Johnson in the church, clustered in front of a large cross with about a dozen other people. They're singing and holding rifles, pistols, and revolvers. One woman has a Bible. Johnson has on a black leather vest with an American flag. He's also wearing two crosses and a cap that says Pope. He has three large silver rings on his right hand, and in it, he's gripping what appears to be an assault rifle. TheGuns.com article says if you're a tattooed, sunburned, gun-toting, leather-wearing biker, you might not be greeted warmly at a regular church, but you're definitely welcome at Heart of Fire. That come-as-you-are philosophy is appealing to a lot of the church's members, like Cliff Richmond, a biker who used to be a regular at Heart of Fire.
It was good stuff. I thought he was doing a really good thing. I thought that he was taking a lot of people that normally wouldn't go to church and getting them to church, which was an awesome thing. But I didn't realize how backwards he was.
Most professional religious leaders have some formal training. Johnson says he does too. In his official biography with the Kentucky State Legislature, Johnson says he has a Ph.D. in theology. He's testified under oath that he has a doctorate of divinity. But as we found out last chapter, you can't take anything Danny Ray Johnson says at face value, especially things he says about himself. So we called the school where he says he got his advanced theological training.
I found two files.
This is Susan Schneider. She works at Kingsway University and Theological Seminary in Des Moines, Iowa. She found Johnson's file and says he did take some classes there, but
there is no record of him receiving an honorary or an earned doctorate degree from us here.
We do know that Johnson did ministry in Louisiana and Louisville for a few years. Then he took his show on the road. Johnson says on his church's website that he spent the late 1980s and early 1990s working in California. He also went on mission trips to South America. That's where he says he healed the sick and even raised the dead. As evidence of these miracles, he cites a letter written in June 1991 by Dr. David Fisher, pastor of Living Waters Church in Pasadena, California. It opens with, "Dear Pastor," but doesn't name anyone specific. It reads kind of like a generic resume booster. The letter says that during a trip to Venezuela, Johnson placed his fingers in the ears of a man who had been deaf since birth. The man was instantly healed. It also describes another miraculous event, this time in Colombia. Fisher says Johnson approached a dead woman with a crowd of 7,000 people watching. The letter describes the woman's skin as lifeless and says it looked like rubber with a darkness under it. She was slumped over in a chair. Danny Ray Johnson lifted her out of it. We'll read you the next part of the letter word for word. Quote, "He spoke to death and commanded it to leave. Then Danny spoke life to her and she took a breath and another breath. She was raised from the dead." Dr. David Fisher, the pastor who wrote the letter, refused to be interviewed on tape. He said in an email that he did not personally witness any of the events his letter describes. Fisher said he got the story from other pastors who told him about it later. He won't say for sure that Danny Ray Johnson raised a woman from the dead in front of thousands of people, but he says it may have happened. Just to be clear, a nonprofit church can't legally support or oppose a political candidate. For Johnson, breaking this law wasn't just a one-time thing. We talked to people who've attended Sunday services at Heart of Fire who said Johnson regularly pushed Trump from the pulpit.
If you were not on the Trump train, you were going to get run over by it. And that's another thing that I thought wasn't quite right. It didn't sit right with me that when I'm going to church, I didn't expect to feel alienated because of any political affiliations.
That's Jennifer Stepp. You heard from her in the first chapter. She's the one who was kicked off the ballot last year before Johnson was chosen to run for the 49th House District seat. Stepp and her daughter used to worship at Heart of Fire Church. She says there's a lot more to the church than Sunday services, like weekend parties.
I was like, oh, wow. I've never seen this at a church before, so it was very different. Sometimes they were getting tattoos there. There I've seen people that would flash the Pope.
What do you mean?
Expose their breast. Like they'd say, instead of saying it's your birthday, it'd be like it's your boob day, you know, so... I can't say I've ever seen him grope a boob, but maybe a butt.
The parties happen in an adjacent fellowship hall called the Pope's House. We went by to check it out. We pulled into the parking lot on a summer Saturday afternoon. The Johnsons were hosting a memorial ride and fundraiser for the family of a local man who'd recently died in a motorcycle crash.
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, buddy.
The Pope's House is a log building with neon signs, beer ads on the door, designated parking for motorcycles. It's just across the driveway from the more traditional worship hall, but it appears to draw much larger crowds. Inside, the walls are lined with motorcycle memorabilia, beer posters, and Confederate flags. There's a clawfoot bathtub full of ice and canned beer, a shelf full of Trump hats and stickers.
How you doing?
Ah, good.
How do you get a beer?
Tickets over there.
Get a ticket over there first. You buy a ticket and then we just give it
then
to you.
Need the
How much is a beer?
$2.
$2.
Danny Ray Johnson is on a stage across the room, auctioning off a gift card for a local tattoo shop. We lean against the bar talking to Charlie, the bartender.
We have a magnificent minister. His name is Bishop Dan Johnson. His nickname is the Pope.
Before long, the Pope's wife, Rebecca Johnson, walks over. She says the church is doing good work, and she thinks we're there to criticize it.
We already know. We already know.
We know what you're going to do, and you know what? You're going to have blood on your hands if you do that. I'm just telling you right now, it's the word of the Lord.
Okay.
You're going to hurt innocent people because you want to smear my husband, and it really upsets me.
Then she points us to the door, and we leave.
Danny Ray Johnson posted a note on a social media platform before he took his own life with a gun near his home. He said, quote, "The accusations from NPR are false. God and only God knows the truth." He went on to talk about his wife, saying, "I love God and I love my wife, who is the best wife in the world, my love forever," end quote. He then implores his family and friends to support his wife, Rebecca Johnson. Now remember, the print version of the story in its entirety was released all at once at the onset. There were some pretty serious allegations in those stories, including one, which is what the next audio chapter is all about. We'll hear some of that episode now. And there is content here that includes descriptions of sexual molestation and might not be appropriate for young listeners.
Shortly after we began our investigation of Danny Ray Johnson, we put in a request with Louisville police asking for all records involving him, just to see what came up. A lot of it was pretty routine, a couple of traffic cases. But then there was this report, vague but shocking. Sexual abuse in the church. The victim, a 17-year-old girl. The suspect, Danny Ray Johnson. Status: case closed. The young woman's name and virtually all other details had been redacted from the document we got from police. But I made some calls, and eventually I found her, Miranda Richmond.
Hello?
Hi, is this Miranda Richmond?
This is she.
Hi, Ms. Richmond. My name is Ralph Dunlop. I work for public...
I couldn't believe she wanted to talk. Plenty of people who report sexual abuse aren't eager to talk about it, even confidentially, much less to be publicly identified. But Richmond was willing to share her story, and on the record. We agreed to meet.
Yeah, I would love to, actually. I will be there at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. I guess I'll see you then.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much, Ralph. Okay.
Miranda Richmond is now 21 years old. More than a decade ago, she started attending the Heart of Fire Church with her father. Danny Ray Johnson was the preacher.
They were practically family to me. You know, I considered him a second dad. I really did.
Cliff Richmond liked Heart of Fire's unconventional approach. Miranda, though, wasn't too crazy about Sunday worship.
The church services were always late. He was always late. You know, it was supposed to start at 12. It wouldn't start till 12:30. It wouldn't end until 3. And then they would have music and stuff in between, you know, some of his speeches and everything. And then afterwards we'd eat. So church was an all-day thing there. It was kind of exhausting.
As the years went on, she became friends with Johnson's younger daughter, Sarah.
Two peas in a pod. We were always together running around, you know, doing our own thing.
The girls often had sleepovers at the church or at the Johnsons' home in Bullitt County. She says sometimes the sleepovers included drinking.
Bud Light beer, but I never liked it, but I drank it anyways because I thought I was cool. Or sometimes they would make mixed drinks for us, and I never knew exactly what it was at the time. Just I would get alcohol and think that it was okay, and I would drink it.
Who made those drinks?
Dan had a few times, but there was other teenagers that had made it before for us.
Richmond's relationship with the church and the Johnson family came to an abrupt end on New Year's Eve in 2012.
I had planned to stay the night there.
Things were getting a little wild.
They allowed underage drinking there. But I did not drink much because I didn't feel well that night, and I remember that.
Richmond remembers that Johnson was in rare form.
He had been drinking a lot at the church that night. He's a drinker. You know, New Year's came and went, and then people started, you know, slowly started going home and everything. Well, eventually it was just me and Sarah just kind of hanging out at the church. Dan had left. I didn't know where they were going. Apparently they were going to a bar. I was not sure where.
A few hours later, Johnson came back.
He was belligerent. He was stumbling, falling on the walls. He came in. He's messing with the doors and he's messing with the lights. I think he was in his head. He was trying to close down the building, make sure it was all locked. That's what it looked like anyways. And we were like, he needs to go to bed. So I was like, well, I'm gonna bring him downstairs, down the steps. So I'm like, hey. And like, I'm literally babying him because I could tell how drunk he was. And I was like, hey, let's go downstairs. You know, you need to go to bed. And so we start going down the steps, and at the time I didn't realize what he was doing, but he was fumbling, and his hand kind of slipped like up my shirt a little bit, but he was also like had his arm around me for balance. So I was like, oh, he's just getting his balance, you know, he's not trying anything. I didn't think at the moment anyways, and he's drunk, you know, whatever. And so I get him all the way down the steps, and I open up their apartment door, and I said, all right, you need to go to bed now, you know, you're drunk, you know, go to sleep. And so then I shut the door and I went back upstairs. Eventually he came back upstairs, and then he was like, you all need to go to bed. And so we're like, okay, that's fine. I mean, we're just watching a movie, you know, might as well go to bed. So we went down to the apartment downstairs, and they have a little living room area with a sectional couch, an L-shaped couch, and that's where we went to sleep.
Dan and Rebecca Johnson were in a room just down the hall.
So we were going to sleep, and I remember Dan coming into the apartment and walking into the kitchen, and I'm falling asleep, and I remember kind of seeing him fumbling around and getting in the fridge, and I'm assuming he was drinking more or getting food or something, I'm not sure, and, you know, eventually dazed off, and that's what I remember falling asleep to. Well, I woke up briefly to feeling him, like, kiss me on the top of my head, which was no big deal. He had always done that to us. He would come in the room, check on us, and tell us goodnight and leave, you know, whether we were at the house or the church. He would do that, so I didn't think anything of it. And I just kind of briefly woke up when he did that, and I was still, like, dazing off and going back to sleep. And then I could feel his hand, like, on my arm and just kind of rubbing my arm for a minute. And, you know, still I'm just like, oh, whatever, he's just checking on us. Well, eventually his arm started to go into my shirt. And so then at that point I'm kind of thinking in my head, like, okay, this isn't okay. I experienced him do this earlier on the steps. Maybe it's not an accident. And so I'm starting to wake up, and I'm kind of realizing what's going on. And then next thing you know, his other hand goes down my pants.
Miranda Richmond is 5'4" tall and weighed about 110 pounds at the time. Johnson is 6'2" and weighs around 200.
He leans down, and he's trying to kiss me on my mouth, and he's like trying to stick his tongue down in my throat. And I could smell and taste the alcohol to this day. I can't get that out of my head. But during all that, I'm thinking, like, how can I make this stop? Like, I'm scared, and I just never expected this. It kind of flipped my whole world upside down as it's happening. And you would think that when a female's in that situation that she would try to be like, get off me, stop, and she would freak out. But I was scared, and I was also, like, I don't know what this strong, drunk man is going to do, and his daughter's laying down. Like, I was just really confused. And so I'm like, hey, no, that's not okay. And he's like, no, it's okay. He starts talking to me. He's like, no, it's okay. You'll like it. And I'm like, no, this is not okay. I was like, you need to go to bed, like I said earlier. And he was like, no, don't worry. It'll feel good. You'll like it. And I'm like, no, it's not. And I'm trying to push him off me, but, like, I'm on a couch, and he's on his knees kneeling over top of me, like pushing down. And I was like, no, it's not okay. I'm not going to like it. You need to go to bed. And so that's all I could think of, to keep saying, you need to go to bed. You need to go to bed. Maybe he'd get in his head. Well, it felt like it went on forever, but it was probably only a few minutes. And finally he stopped, and he was like, okay. And he got up and he went to bed, and he went into his room and he shut the door.
She stayed awake all night and left early the next morning, just after sunrise. She said she immediately called her boyfriend at the time.
And I was in the car, and I just started breaking down. I was freaking out. I felt weird about it, and I felt weird to be able to go see my boyfriend and not tell him. And so I had pulled over on the road because I was crying so hysterically I couldn't see. And I had texted him what happened because I knew I wasn't going to be able to talk and tell him because I was hysterically crying. And so I texted him everything. I told him word for word what happened. And I've never been back to that church since.
There's more to this chapter, and I really want to mention again that this series in its entirety is worth a listen. We can't fit it all here, so we're only pulling pieces. Chapter 4 goes on to explain what happened next in Miranda Richmond's life and how political, legal, and law enforcement systems failed her. Then, in Chapter 5, we learn more about all the systems that, well, failed, and allowed someone with a background that includes a child molestation charge, arson, and fraud, and a history of lying to rise to the role of statehouse lawmaker in Kentucky. It was also refreshing to hear both Dunlop and Ryan, as reporters, point to themselves as part of the larger media system that is failing to keep people informed.
And that brings us to the final piece in our examination of systemic failures, the media. Where were we? Chuck Clark is director of student publications at Western Kentucky University. He previously worked at 9 newspapers in a half dozen states.
The only thing that makes American democracy work is having an informed public, an informed electorate. There's a difference between journalism and information. Information is whatever you throw out there. Journalism is vetting that information, testing it, prosecuting it, questioning it, trying to poke holes in it to see if you really have the accurate information. There is a world of difference between finding something on Facebook and reading it in the Washington Post or the New York Times.
Clark's concerned about the current state of journalism. Most newsrooms have fewer resources now, so they have to make value judgments about what to cover. Shallow, popular topics bring the online clicks that please advertisers. It takes an investment of time and money to cover topics that are important but not so flashy, like local legislative races.
It requires editors and reporters to get with their community and make some tough decisions. They have to figure out what is important in their community. What, you know, are they going to give up? Because they're going to have to give up something if they want to be excellent at certain things, because there are fewer resources to spread around.
So, do you all have any thoughts about his statements about the media and also criticizing the media?
Well, not only Mr. Johnson, but his widow, Rebecca Johnson, even more so, I think, made statements, very negative statements about the media following his death. I don't think any of his assertions or hers had any merit, but they really weren't interested in discussion or debate. They just wanted to try to take somebody down and to tarnish people without any factual basis whatsoever. And we saw a lot of that and heard a lot of that with her, how the media were somehow to blame for the travail that her family has incurred and for Mr. Johnson's death. And And, you know, you can say it, but there's no evidence. There's not a shred of evidence. He killed himself, period. And we did our job, and we think we did it well. And neither she nor anybody else has produced any evidence whatsoever that suggests we were unfair or untruthful.
Oftentimes, I think we've seen that the word, the phrase fake news is meant to kind of deride reports that are just not shining the person saying fake news in a positive light. They're oftentimes a way to discredit legitimate reporting that is just not favorable to the person that's being reported upon. But
they don't like it.
Yeah, they don't like it, so they call it fake news, which is so easy for them to do, but it's damaging to this entire industry and to the stuff that we do and you do every single day.
You presented factual information in your reports, obviously, and you also made some seemingly observational statements and, well, called Dan Johnson a liar. Was there any discussion around this type of strong language, as you put it in the piece?
Yes, a great deal of discussion among us, between Jake and me, Jake and I and our editors, and also lawyers at the table. These stories were lawyered exhaustively, literally pretty much line by line. Story up on a screen, we're going through the wording. And so there was a lot of careful thought given to what we can say and whether we have support for what we're saying. And we thought the evidence clearly supported the characterization of Mr. Johnson as a liar because he repeatedly said things that weren't true.
R.G. Dunlop and Jacob Ryan, reporters with the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, speaking about their series called The Pope's Long Con. To end the show, I want to share more from Dan Johnson's last public words. It read, "Only three things I ask of you to do. If you love me, one, blame no person. Satan is the accuser, so blame the devil himself. Two, forgive and love everyone, especially yourself. Three, most importantly, love God. P.S. I love my friends. You are my family. God loves all people, no matter what." End quote. Of course, the lines are open for interpretation. Maybe it's a last attempt to salvage his public legacy, or perhaps it's one last effort to empower his followers, the forgotten, the outcast, the sinners, to know that they're loved or wanted, and that there's hope for new beginnings. The line about Satan stood out to me. Well, this whole show, really, I keep coming back to this word, accountability. Whether it's blaming the devil, making excuses for abusive behavior, or the work we, as journalists, do or don't do every day. Perhaps we all could learn more from mistakes if we were more open to accountability rather than excuses. No, we can't change the past, but we can move forward to learn and make better decisions based on what we learned. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting and WFPL in Louisville. Music in today's show was provided by Ben Townsend. Musical scoring in The Pope's Long Con was the work of Kevin Ratterman, and the theme song was Seventh Son by Willie Dixon, recorded by Ratterman and featuring Patrick Halliman, Alex Rickle, Scott Carney, and Otis Jr., with backing vocals from Hannah Sexton and Savannah Eckler. Glennis Board produced and mixed our episode this week. Roxy Todd edited this episode. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. Molly Bourne is our web editor. Don't forget, you can subscribe or download all of our stories wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.